Well, thank you very much for that introduction. It's a pleasure to speak to you here today. I will apologise to perhaps some of you who might be here from Sydney. You might have seen parts of this presentation at an industry function last week in Sydney, but I've added a few more slides to try and spice it up a bit. It was Richard Foster that actually presented this last week, so thank you, Richard, for your contribution. And I've thrown a few more slides in to give you a bit more value if you've travelled to Melbourne today. But I'm sure you don't need my slides to actually enjoy some value and add to other states' revenue while you're here for a couple of days, hopefully. I guess my first question is, are PPPs dead? I want to move on to... Okay, there we go. I wanted to start with a couple of slides that probably actually demonstrate the irony of media announcements. So, back in December 2008, the chief executive of the Australian Public Trustees said that PPPs were dead in the water. He was very specific about that. It's all over, thank you very much. Except that the Victorian Premier came out within a week and said, we've just closed the school's PPP transaction, which was a very successful transaction. So I guess the debate to some extent today is about whether PPPs are dead or not. To give it some context, I think this is really important. PPPs, as we know them under the current sort of policy and model, go back to about 2000 in Victoria. So if we look back over the last 8 years, it's worthwhile actually asking the question, what is a normal market? And certainly the market in PPPs back in 2002, for example, was different to the market that we saw a year ago, or even 2 years ago when we closed projects like the Children's Hospital, which gave us significant value, probably, and greater value, or the government and the taxpayers, greater value than what we saw in the very early projects such as the Casey Hospital. So the market in terms of risk transfer and value has moved on, and I think we need to keep that in context. The other question that's raised here is in the 1990s, some questioned the market's ability to finance CityLink project. So today, with the financial problems we have, whilst they are more extensive, is there some deja vu occurring here? It's important to have a look at the cause and effect. So the global financial crisis has affected financing, pricing, tenure, capacity and volatility. There is absolutely no doubt about that, to a great extent. But let's unravel some of this. Let's unbundle it. Some commentators have linked the global financial crisis with other more medium-term issues such as demand or traffic risk on toll roads and concerns around complex procurement processes. They are issues that we need to continue to work on. They are issues, and you heard from Wal in his presentation about the huge cost of bidding for these projects. So we need to continue to take out some of the complexity where possible in terms of processes. In terms of demand risk or traffic risk, yes, it is affected to some extent by the GFC because there's less appetite for revenue risk particularly. So banks today are saying we're not prepared to take the risk that we did, the traffic risk that we did. So it's linked, but I see it as a separate issue to the fundamental liquidity issue that I'm talking about right now. The other thing that's occurred in infrastructure in Australia, as well as other parts of the world, is a great shift in infrastructure spending. So we're seeing record levels of infrastructure investment at both the state and federal government levels. And the Commonwealth has dealt itself clearly into this infrastructure space through the establishment of Infrastructure Australia and the earmarking of funds in the Building Australia Fund, as well as the Health and Education Funds that they've established. So this increase in investment was firmly on the national agenda before the global financial crisis came about, and that has, in some ways, exacerbated the problem that we have today. Moving on to the role of PPPs. Until recently, PPPs were a little used procurement method. So in terms of the traditional procurement methods that we talk about at times, construction, design separate to construction, construction, D&Cs, which have gone back over many decades, PPPs are really something of the current decade. They've been embraced by some states early, Victoria, New South Wales, other states have come on board. But now, I think it is fair to say that all jurisdictions in Australia are exploring PPPs for particularly the value for money they generate. I'm going to talk a little bit more about what is value for money. The risk transfer, innovation, that's a strong point of mine. I think the innovation we see through these procurement this procurement approach is outstanding in many bids, and the flexibility that PPPs can afford to government cash flows. However, PPPs can take longer than traditional projects to reach contract execution. I guess from a government perspective, I would in fact rather see some of the more traditional approaches to procuring infrastructure, keeping in mind that only about 10% of the infrastructure that's delivered by the Victorian government is delivered through PPPs. So that other 90%, I'd prefer government to be taking a bit more time about some of that sometimes, because the investment that you make in planning and good process up front will actually result in a better outcome. So I'm not sure this is a shortcoming of PPPs to actually be well planned. However, the commercial drivers in PPPs do mean that you end up with a much shorter construction time. We've spent some time, and there's some studies looking at the initial announcement of government in respect to a project and when it's finally completed or commissioned. And if you look at that entire time frame, there is little difference between PPBs and traditional procurement. And there's a demonstrated cost and time certainty of PPPs, which is particularly valuable in this environment where we need to be even more prudent with our investment dollars. And I'll come back to that in a couple of minutes. In fact, we'll move on to that now. Through the benchmarking study, there was a benchmarking study concluded in December last year, undertaken by the University of Melbourne for the National PPP Forum, which is a forum that has representatives from all jurisdictions. It, over a period of years, this is a long, arduous exercise, but over a period of about 3 years, Melbourne University looked at 42 traditional projects and 25 PPs to assess the outcomes, the value for money outcomes, comparing one with the other. I'll take you to that study in a minute. The good thing about this study was it was predominantly government information that was used in this study, so it had the data actually had a high level of credibility. Project directors were interviewed for their input, etc., so we went right to the horse's mouth. And that overcame some of the criticism of some earlier studies, similar studies that have been undertaken in the UK, such as the Mott MacDonald study. But they're all indicators, and I'm going to put all this information together in a table for you in a couple of minutes. The other point I'd like to make right now is that accounting treatment really is, from a government's perspective, fairly inconsequential. And that statement forms part of the story. That's a little confusing up there. The slides didn't quite translate, I don't think. But I hope you can see it. So going to this study undertaken by Melbourne University for the National PPP Forum, it clearly shows that for the full period, that's the period from the government announcement of a project through to commissioning or completion of construction, cost overruns in traditional projects were up to 52%, whereas in PPPs it was 28%, a difference of 28.2%. I'll go to another study that was undertaken a little earlier than this, so it was around the middle of last year. Again, the University of Melbourne was involved in this study with the Allens Consulting Group, which was commissioned for Infrastructure Partnerships Australia, looked at a sample that was similar, although a little smaller, and this study relied predominantly on publicly available information. So it was either reported information or something that came out in a post-project review or an Auditor General's report, etc. The thing is, it doesn't show significant differences in terms of outcomes. The bottom line is the difference between cost overruns in traditional procurement and PPPs is around 24%. Moving to the balance sheet issue and the cash flow issue that we hear a lot of discussion about in industry forums, I just wanted to demonstrate to you that the two outcomes, I guess, in terms of cash flows for government, traditional procurement, where government is funding the construction costs and other project management costs up front, you see this huge spike in those cash flows, with much smaller cash flows over the life of the project, paying for the maintenance and operation of the facility. Whereas in a PPP, those cash flows are spread a lot more evenly over the entire life of the project. Going to the balance sheet, again, there are differences in terms of, or there's timing differences in terms of how PPPs affect the balance sheet compared to traditional procurement. But again, the ultimate outcome at the end of commissioning, is the same. So the balance sheet effect on the balance sheet is the same. The other point I want to make here is that in governments, all Australian jurisdictions, not necessarily all international jurisdictions, but in Australia, we account for the capital and recurrent investment that government will make effectively through a payment of services over the life of the project in our forward estimates. So when we produce a budget and there's a project hospital being approved as part of that budget process, that capital budget and the future recurrent budget, also, although sometimes that sits outside the forward estimates period, but that capital budget sits in those forward estimates. So the government has committed to funding that project regardless of who actually provides the cash. Just like to say a couple of words about measuring value for money. The value for money has, when we talk about value for money and quantify that, we typically, something's happening here, but it's not happening up there, so it's okay, I think. What we've done traditionally is measure the outcome in terms of the PPP against this public sector comparator that Wal referred to earlier. But I agree, Wal, it is a hypothetical outcome, because what we do in terms of the PSC is estimate what we believe the cost of the project and its recurrent or ongoing costs might be if we were to build the project itself. Of course, we can't do both. We can't have the private sector build it as a PP and we build it ourselves. So it is hypothetical. So is this the only measure of value for money? Okay. We've got the right slide here, but it's up there now. Sorry about that. Okay. But somebody's taken control. I mentioned earlier there have been a number of studies now that have compared PPP to traditional procurement, and there's a bit much information on this slide, and I'll come back to it. But those include the Treasury Task Force in the UK, Mott MacDonald I referred to, a study undertaken by Peter Fitzgerald, a different Peter Fitzgerald to the one we have with us today. He did the study for Victorian PPPs back in 2004, measured value for money against the PSC. But then there's the two research projects that were undertaken with the help of the University of Melbourne last year. So we've now got actually an increasing body of evidence in terms of the performance of PPPs. Additional value for money. I think there's always value, typically we see value around scope. I talked a little earlier about innovation, and in these projects, the EastLink Freeway and the Royal Children's Hospital, we certainly saw significant innovation, which gave us a different additional scope in that project. And we don't tend to quantify that, but I don't think we should dismiss it, because it is real value for the state. The other interesting and challenging, I think, issue is that for PPPs, we undertake a very thorough public interest test. So we look at things like the effectiveness of the project, the equity outcomes for all Victorians, consumer rights. So we do a fairly detailed piece of work around public interest in PPPs. We typically don't do it for traditional procurement. I often ask why, but we never seem to get there. So again, public interest in PPPs is robust. PPPs in an illiquid financial environment. So good PPPs are still viable in the current market. Funding constraints may cap project size. Again, you heard Wal say that perhaps the largest projects that can be fully funded by the market are in the range of $500 million to $1 billion. That's what I hear from the market as well. So fully funded projects by the private sector may be capped in terms of size. However, policy responses are required or may be required to finance particularly the larger projects. But again, I want to come back to a point I made earlier when I was talking about the balance sheet and cash flows. Remember that these projects, even if they're large, and even if they can't be fully funded by the private sector in today's market, the government has actually earmarked the funding for those projects. So the funding is available. It's not a pass or fail test. These projects and projects that the Victorian government has announced will proceed. What's changing here? The world has changed considerably in terms of how financing is structured, so it's a much more deregulated market. A de-geared market. It's more regulated, I'm sorry. A more de-geared world, which means that I expect going forward we will see, and banks that are financing these projects will insist on a higher level of equity in these projects. That's not any different to the corporate lending market or any other financial market that we are experiencing at the moment. The interesting thing is some policy responses may also be required on traditionally delivered projects. So jurisdictions that have very large infrastructure investment programs may well need to, or governments may well need to take some sort of policy response in how governments actually finance their infrastructure spend. But on that point, I want to say in Victoria, the budget now is still in very good shape. Financially, we're in good shape. We don't feel the pressure of these financing constraints currently that exist in the market. So will PPP survive? We might learn something from Mark Twain. So the PPP model, in my view, is not broken, even if financial markets are suffering. For appropriately selected projects, they still offer value for money, risk transfer, cash flow flexibility. All those things I've talked about, I believe, can be still achieved through the PPP model. Coming back to the chart I put up earlier, my view, I think, look, there's no doubt that it's somewhat more difficult to achieve the same sort of value for money as measured against the PSC. But as I've said before, there are many other measures. There's measures through comparing PPPs to traditional procurement. We've got some research on that now. Standard & Poor's came out a year or so ago. They did a large survey. 61% of those surveyed said that they believe PPPs provided better outcomes in terms of delivery. Ernst & Young recently issued a report. They interviewed the managers and operators of social infrastructure PPP projects and got their feedback on how these projects actually work in reality. And we see a full public interest test applied to all PPP projects. So a final thought, but clearly this thought demonstrates in my mind that PPPs are not dead and will continue to offer value for money for taxpayers in all jurisdictions. Thank you very much.